This is White Sox Weekly. Your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago. Now here's your host, Connor McKnight.
Welcome in, White Sox Weekly. Early on a Saturday, the early first pitch today with the White Sox taking on the Yankees. With you on a Saturday morning for White Sox Weekly, Connor McKnight with the day off. I'm Shane Orling, sitting in for Connor. Got a full show. A lot of news to break down with the White Sox, who've been better lately. A little bit more on that in a moment, despite the loss last night. Going to have a lot on the show for you. Talk to Gary Phillips of the New York Daily News, a Yankees beat writer, can fill us in on what's been going on in the Bronx this season as the Yankees off to a very hot 31-15 start. White Sox taking on the Yankees today. The loss last night, 4-2. We'll also talk to James Fox, the managing editor and podcast host at Future Sox. Looking forward to that conversation. Some prospect news that's been coming out with the White Sox. Actually, good news lately as well. So very excited to get into that. White Sox did lose last night, 4-2. It was Mike Clevinger on the mound taking the loss for the Sox. Nestor Cortez picked up the win on the Yankees side. And Tommy Pham stayed hot. Three hits in the game. What a pickup Tommy Pham has been. And I've talked about this a little bit. And I think in the past week, it's only gotten a little stronger that some of these pickups who were kind of, I'm not saying it to be disrespectful. It's just what's said. These kind of garbage heap guys that nobody seemed to want that have come to the White Sox and played really, really well. That is continuing to be valuable to me when I think about how we're going to look back on the 2024 season. I think we all kind of understand the result at this point and know what it's going to be. But when you think about some of these one-year guys and some of the opportunities that are starting to present themselves for general manager Chris Getz, opportunities to turn some of these veteran one-year players into future prospects, that can flip what is currently a bottom third farm system into middle of the pack, if not top third in baseball. If you make some savvy moves, if you have the ability to get back decent prospects for players, and the trades have already begun. Just in the news this week, kind of under the radar, the White Sox did make a trade, sent a pitching prospect to Houston for outfielder Corey Jolks. And if you're not familiar with Corey Jolks, he's had a slower start maybe than expected to his major league career. His first rookie season, older rookie season, 27 years of age in Houston, didn't get consistent playing appearances, played appearances, only played in 93 games, OPS plus of about 81. Had a hit last night for the White Sox in his debut against the Yankees. But this is a guy who just a couple of years ago had 31 home runs in the minor leagues and flashed a lot of power, flashed a good bat, had an opportunity to get called up in Houston. And I think when you wonder, oh, well, why are the Astros trading away this guy? And the fact is, I don't really believe that the Astros necessarily wanted to do this. The Astros are in a position where this season is not going the way that they had hoped. And they are in a position where they might need to pick up some prospects. And Corey Jolks, frankly, there was a logjam in their outfield. There's too much talent on the Astros team for Jolks to get meaningful playing time in Houston. So you kind of, if you're Houston, are doing Corey Jolks a favor by sending him to a place where he will have the opportunity to play a little bit more often. And you're picking up a pitching prospect to do it. I think it's a good deal, really, for both sides. The prospect the White Sox gave up, Luis Rodriguez, a 20-year-old, hasn't pitched above the complex league. That is a guy, there's promise when you think about a 20-year-old pitching prospect, and maybe you start to wonder why the process is getting rid of guys like that. Keep in mind, if you're 20 years old and you haven't pitched above the complex league, you are still a long way away. And there is the long-held belief among a lot of baseball people. They call it tinstop. There is no such thing as a pitching prospect. So if you have an opportunity to get an upside bat, which I think Corey Jolks is, and bring him into your lineup and put him in a position where he can get the playing time that he wasn't being afforded in Houston, and all it's going to cost you is a dice roll with a 20-year-old pitcher who hasn't moved above the complex league, I'm going to call that a fairly decent move. And I'm not saying that this is high stakes or anything. I think it's reasonably low stakes. I think the idea that Corey Jolks comes in and becomes an all-star, that's not what I'm trying to say. I don't think this is some trade that's going to overhaul the organization. But I think it's another one of these kind of small moves that Chris Getz stands to win. And that's going to be the really important thing this year. 312-332-3776 is the phone number if you want to weigh in on this conversation. For me, this year is not about finding a way to solve any of the issues on the roster. This year, we know what it is. This year is about finding small victories in asset management for Chris Getz. And so far, I think it's hard to argue that he's done a really good job with what he's been given. And the ability to find players like Chris Flexen, who Bob Nightingale reported is now a hot name on the trade market, or somebody like Eric Fetty, who will almost certainly be a hot name on the trade market, if not one of the leading names on the trade market with the way that he's pitched. Some early Cy Young talk earlier this week as Eric Fetty leads. Kevin Zipak, one of our producers, giving me a side eye. I'm not telling you he's going to win it, but he does lead American League pitchers and wins above replacement. As of today, the likelihood that he continues to do that for the remainder of the season, some of the favorites, obviously Corbin Burns in Baltimore, the current favorite, Tarek Skubal in Detroit, do stand a better chance at ultimately winning the award. But Eric Fetty pitching at that kind of caliber for the period of time that he has, it's a good thing to see. And it speaks to the Tommy Pham edition as well. It speaks to all of it, this ability by Chris Getz to hunt for guys who were not viewed as valuable by Major League Baseball. And I ultimately believe this is not a report or this is not anything of substance. This is my own speculation and opinion. But I ultimately believe the move is you can flip some of these one-year guys to contending teams and get prospects back. You're putting yourself in a good position. The loss last night to the Yankees, I don't think it should mire what's been happening in the month of May if you haven't been paying as close of attention. The White Sox have been playing better baseball. In April, everything was horrific. In April, it was like a nightmare month of baseball where the pitching was terrible, the hitting was terrible, the base running was terrible, the fielding, all of it just felt, why can't any of this get right? And in the month of May, you're off to an 8-7 start. And I think that that is something that is important in the sense, look, the offense is what it is. The offense, especially without Luis Robert, who will start a rehab assignment as soon as next week per manager Pedro Grifol, without Luis Robert, the offense is going to be one of the bottom third in baseball. It's just, it is what it is. The White Sox don't have the bats to be significantly better than that. But I don't really have to squint as hard to find positives anymore when I can pull up the month of May, and it's not a huge sample size, but we're at a 15-game sample at this point, and the White Sox have an above 500 record in that sample. And they're also eighth in Major League Baseball in pitching wins above replacement. They're eighth in earned run average. This is a pitching staff led by guys who, again, likely will not be in Chicago for very long, but it's starting to put some things together, and the results are what they are. Now, the White Sox aren't going to be a team that scores five and a half runs a game. It's just not reality. But if the run prevention can stay where it is, then I think you are looking at a team that can win some of those low-scoring games, can start getting a taste of winning, and hopefully this culture that we know Pedro Grifol and Chris Getz want to instill can catch on a little bit. They say winning's allergic. or contagious, rather. Winning is contagious, and you start to do it, and you start to feel a little better and enter games with some more confidence. I think it's especially important for some of the young guys who we expect to see. Brian Ramos, who's had a nice little run here in his starts. You look at eventually Colson Montgomery, who we expect to get called up at some point as he starts to heat up in AAA Charlotte. So I think this past month in May, and it's only been a couple of weeks, it's only been 15 games. The sample size is what it is, but you're starting to see some of the positives show. And young teams like this that don't have a ton of high expectations as contenders or as competitive ball clubs, oftentimes in the month of April, get off to these glacially slow starts, and it kind of corrects itself. And again, the hope for me is just that Chris Getz can find ways to get some of these young guys opportunities and win some of the deals with the veteran players. And I feel like it's trending in that direction. Told you we got a lot to do on the show today. Gary Phillips, New York Daily News, a Yankees beat writer, will join me next to talk some of Yankees baseball off to a very hot start this season, 31-15 after the win over the White Sox last night. That's a Yankees team that in past seasons the fan base has not been especially thrilled with, outside of Aaron Judge, but Giancarlo Stanton's playing well. The pitching staff has been a huge surprise, one of the best in baseball. Their run prevention's incredible. So a lot to talk about the Yankees as Gary Phillips, New York Daily News, joins me next on White Sox Weekly. Remember, learn from the pros this summer at a White Sox summer camp presented by Wintrust, starting at $165. Kids ages 5 to 12 can register for a four-day baseball camp offered at over 35 locations throughout the Chicagoland area. To learn more, visit whitesox.com/play. White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino, White Sox Network. It's White Sox Weekly. Connor McKnight with the day off. I'm Shane Orland sitting in. Good news for reggaeton music fans. Join us at the ballpark on Friday, May 24th for Reggaeton Night, as the Sox take on the Orioles at 6:40 p.m. Be sure to stay after the game for a post-game fireworks show. And to purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Right now, I want to talk a little Yankees. White Sox taking on the Yankees today. It was a 4-2 loss last night. And Gary Phillips of the New York Daily News, Yankees beat writer, joins me. Gary, how are we doing? Gary?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, got you loud and clear. How's it going in New York?
It's going well. Thanks for having me on. How are you guys doing in Chicago?
Well, we're doing great today. And I'm actually excited to talk a little Yankee baseball with you. I have a few friends that are Yankees fans, and I think they're one of the more fascinating teams this season in that they have started off so well. And I remember last offseason talking to some of my friends, and remember, these people are fans, short for fanatic. Their opinions always seem to be over the top. But it was a lot of, boy, how long can Brian Cashman continue as the general manager, the executive? How long can Aaron Boone continue as the manager? And the skepticism around what this team might be with the pitching staff being what it was coming in. Carlos Rodon, Nestor Cortez, maybe not pictures of perfect health. So far this season, you're 31-15. I mean, the vibe has to be fantastic.
Yeah, that's been one of the more noticeable differences this season so far. Obviously, the record is better, the team is better, but also just the vibes are so significantly different than what they were last year. And I'm not even talking about, you know, just the end of the season, August, September last year, when the Yankees kind of knew they were out of it. Even in the summer months and the dog days, you know, there was kind of this sense that, like, this team just wasn't that good and was heading toward a playoff absence or, you know, a mediocre season at best. And now there's just so much swagger, confidence. There's definitely a different aura around the team. I think new guys like Juan Soto, Alex Verdugo, Marcus Stroman have had a lot to do with that. They've all kind of been allowed to be themselves. And, you know, anybody who knows the game knows those three guys are very energetic, individualistic personalities. So it's been a good match so far.
How much of this early season success can be attributed to Giancarlo Stanton having what is a relatively very good season for him as of late?
Yeah, I think he's been a huge boost for this lineup. You didn't really know what you were going to get out of him, but his job is to hit home runs and drive in RBIs, right? And he's doing that. You know, he's second on the team in homers. He's right up there in RBIs. He's still not getting on base, you know, at an above 300 clip, which is weird for a guy that always has prior to the last three seasons. So there's still some imperfections there. You know, he's still a little limited mobility. You don't get the roster flexibility with him because he's not playing the outfield. But his job is to hit home runs and drive in runs, and he's doing that right now. I don't think you could say that was going to be a guarantee coming into the year.
And the on-base percentage hovering right around 300, and as long as he continues to hit for power, I think Yankee fans, correct me if I'm wrong, would be happy to give up a little bit of the on-base clip to get the home runs back.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think right now he's serving as a nice number three, but behind, you know, Soto and Judge kind of forming that Batman-Robin combo.
I look through this lineup, too, and is six of the nine everyday position players OPS plus over 100. A lot of the bench has an OPS plus over 100. Really, it's just you would expect some struggles from guys like Oswaldo Cabrera, Gleyber Torres maybe struggling a little more than expected. But it feels like this Yankee team for once is able to overcome some of the struggles rather than let the struggles bring them down.
Yeah, and you've seen that too, because there was a stretch, you know, before the last 2 weeks or so where Judge wasn't necessarily performing up to expectations. Gleyber Torres has gotten a little hotter, but he has not had a good season up to this point. You know, Volpe had a really great start and has been really good recently, but he had a down stretch in the middle. So they're definitely a lot deeper this year. You know, last year they could not overcome, you know, two or three regulars struggling like they have this season.
I want to talk a little bit about the pitching staff as well. Gerrit Cole, first of all, is there an update on when the thought is he might be back?
There's still no timeline yet for him to face hitters. So as far as when he's going to get back is still a ways off. You know, the Yankees have been hesitant to put any kind of target date on it. We've heard, you know, middle of June. We asked Aaron Boone about 2 weeks ago whether the All-Star break might be realistic. They're not going to put a stamp on it just yet. Now, he still needs to progress to facing live hitters. That's the next significant step in his recovery. From there, you know, he would still need a spring training's worth of rehab games or starts, so to speak. So still a little too early to know, but I would, you know, sometime this summer is still the target.
Talking with Gary Phillips, New York Daily News on the New York Yankees. White Sox set to take on the Yankees this afternoon. This pitching staff without Cole, I think, has been kind of the biggest surprise with the Yankees. You look at all of their starters under 4 ERA, almost all of them under 3.5, with Nestor Cortez just a hair over that clip. Carlos Rodon staying healthy, being effective. But the big surprise, and the one that for me, frankly, is really good to see, feels like Clark Schmidt is putting everything together finally.
Yeah, it definitely does. And you've heard Clark since the start of last year talk about how there's more, how he's going to force the Yankees' hand and, you know, force Aaron Boone to leave him in games longer and pry the ball from him. Well, you're seeing it the last two starts especially, but he has grown so much from this time last year when he was still getting shelled a little bit every time out. Then he goes on and he has a fantastic summer, fantastic middle of the season, cooled down a little bit toward the end of last season, but I think you got to attribute a little of that to fatigue, maybe the league starting to learn him a little bit. He comes back this year with, you know, a few tweaks, you know, to his arsenal, to his routine, and he's been the best pitcher on the staff. It's been pretty impressive what he's been able to accomplish. And on top of that, he's now going out for a lengthy start. So we'll see if he can keep that up.
And the other thing with Cole is when he comes back, and I'm operating under the assumption that Cole returns and obviously Carlos Rodon, Cortez, both still healthy. What do you do with this rotation? Because the easy answer for me would be you replace Luis Gil with Gerrit Cole. But when you have a 26-year-old that's as highly touted as Luis Gil was, and he's pitching as well as he is to start this season, that doesn't make it feel like an easy answer.
Yeah, it's a great question that started to been asked. You know, obviously there's no rush with Cole not even getting in games just yet, but Heal has been so dominant and so tantalizing and still has, you know, room for refinement, room for growth. So it feels like it would be foolish in a sense to put him in the bullpen, even though you could easily see him being a 2-3 inning dominant force in relief. I don't see how you could do it right now. You know, if you put a gun to my head and said you got to pick a guy to swap out with Cole right now, I'd say, okay, maybe it's Nestor Cortez. But these things also have a way of working themselves out. And the other thing I would add is that Heal has never thrown a full season's worth of innings in a year. You've got Cortez and Rodon coming off, you know, very limited injury-shortened seasons last year, so they're going to have a large build-up as far as their workload is concerned. Last year, Schmidt threw a career high for innings pitched, so you got to watch his workload a little bit. Somehow I feel this is going to figure itself out, whether it's, you know, occasionally using six men at a time, whether it's swapping guys in and out here and there to give them rest, manipulating the rotation schedule around off days. I don't know that it's a binary, you know, someone's got to go just because Cole comes back. So we'll see when that time comes. But like I said, there's still a little time between now and then.
Could there be any kind of a shutdown strategy with Heal as you get later in the season? It's funny to me. It's a guy we've heard about for so long, and we've seen at the Yankee level in flashes a few times in the past 3 years, but he is still a rookie.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. The Yankees have said that he's not necessarily on an innings limit. You know, they've talked about how they have more advanced ways now for measuring a guy's level of fatigue, his strength as the season goes on, the quality of his stuff. So the Yankees have said they're going to pay attention to those metrics and that technology, see what it tells them as far as Heal is concerned, and they're going to base it off of that opposed to, oh, you're at 100 innings, it's time to shut you down. So we'll see where that data and information takes them. We'll certainly see how Heal's performance, you know, over the next few weeks and months, where that takes them as well. But it's certainly possible that they take it easy with him. You know, you got to remember he is coming off of Tommy John surgery.
Yeah. Gary, appreciate you taking some time to join us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. That was Gary Phillips, New York Daily News on the Yankees beat. Good to talk a little Yankee baseball ahead of White Sox Yankees today. We will talk to James Fox of Future Sox next, but first let's pause 10 seconds for station identification. James Fox joins me next on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino, White Sox Network. White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino, White Sox Network. Sox fans, bring your group to the ballpark with a family pack presented by ExxonMobil. Check out our newly added June game dates and plan your next summer outing. Each purchase includes a game ticket, hot dog, drink, bag of chips, and a cookie. Good deal. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. All right, joining me now on White Sox Weekly, James Fox of Future Sox for a little prospect talk. James, how are we doing?
Hey, Shay. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm glad to have you on. So I want to start with the name that everybody knows when you talk about White Sox prospects, and he's been getting a little hot lately in AAA. How soon can we expect to see Colson Montgomery?
Yeah, I mean, so if you would have asked me the question about a month ago, like when it wasn't looking very good, you know, I wouldn't have known how to answer. He's much better in May. You know, finally walking, the power started to show. So I think if you kind of look at those May numbers, and even overall with, like, how bad his first month was, I mean, he still has a WRC plus, I think, in, like, the 105 range. So he's still been a positive offensive contributor, even with all the struggles. I think if we see him, you know, my guess is it's still after the All-Star break, just because they want to, like, give him more runway in AAA, and I think they're probably going to trade some vets. I do think we see him, though. I just think anything before that, I'd still be a little bit surprised. But definitely the second half, I think we see him for sure.
You look through, like, the prospect list and the top 30 in the system, there aren't a lot of ETA 2024 guys. It's Montgomery, it's Ramos, who's already up, Iriarte, and a couple others. But how many can we really expect to see this year? Because to me, it does feel like a season where you want to get some of these young guys more opportunities rather than limit them as much as possible.
Yeah, for sure. I would say not as many on the hitter side, for sure. I think you could see any number of pitchers. I mean, obviously, we've seen Nick Mastrini, we've seen Jonathan Cannon, both around the 40-man. You know, two guys from the Dylan Cease return, Drew Thorpe and Jairo Iriarte are both on the 40-man roster as well. They're in Double-A. I don't think it's as important for some of these guys to pitch at Charlotte. So I think if you just, like, see promotions from Birmingham, it's not going to be that surprising. But I think any number of these arms, like there's, you know, you got Kai Bush, who you acquired in a trade last year. You have Jake Eater. So there's just any number of pitchers who I think we'll definitely see, because look, like we just kind of talked about, they're going to make trades. But on the position player side, I mean, Brian Ramos is in Chicago. I don't think Edgar Caro sees the big leagues this year. So, you know, unless they're getting somebody else's close to the majors offensive prospects back, like in trades, like, yeah, we're probably not going to see much help, like, on the offensive side.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but when I look at a guy like Eric Fetty or Tommy Pham having these kind of, frankly, outstanding seasons that nobody really expected and obviously are trade candidates as we approach the deadline, what's kind of the expected return? And could you get, I mean, you just brought up, they might get prospects who are closer in timeline to being in the majors. Are you expecting to get guys who maybe can make major league appearances in August and September?
Maybe, but I think they have to just, like, take the best return, right? I think even if like, your best package for Eric Fetty is two guys that are in high A, I think that's the trade that you have to make. But, yeah, like, it wouldn't be surprising at all. I do think they'll get quite a bit for Eric Fetty because this, like, the changes seem very real, and he's only on a 2-year deal, and signing as a Scott Boras guy, like, you know, it's not even an ownership thing. It's just, I don't know that guy is going to be super willing to sign like another team friendly deal soon. So like, if you don't think you're going to be good next year, you kind of have to trade Eric Fetty. And if he keeps pitching like this, I mean, you know, getting a top 100 prospect plus another organizational top 10 isn't out of the question. Tommy Pham, I have no idea. The White Sox were able to trade Robbie Grossman for, like, a usable guy, like a reliever in Double A that might be able to pitch for you soon, right? Like, not a huge prospect, but, like, you know, a guy that you might be able to use on your next decent team for Robbie Grossman. If it's something similar for Tommy Pham, like, I think that's a win, personally.
I also want to talk about the trade the White Sox made a little bit earlier this week. They got Corey Jolks out of Houston. Kind of just a positional logjam for Houston that didn't have the space for Jolks to regularly be in the lineup or in the outfield. What are the White Sox giving up in 20-year-old Luis Rodriguez? He hasn't pitched a lot. I don't know if anybody knows a ton about him, and it feels like one of those guys just so far away you can afford to give that up.
I think that's fine. I think if that deal was cash, it's basically the same thing. I mean, okay. I do like our international coverage at Future Sox, and I'm not going to pretend like I know a ton about Luis Rodriguez, but he's a low 90s guy that was, like, thrown out of the bullpen, and he hasn't, you know, pitched at a full-season affiliate yet. I don't think that one's a big deal. You know, and look, I don't know what Corey Jolks is. Like, he might be able to help, like, a fifth-place team, like, get to the finish line here, right? He was fairly highly regarded in the Astros system years ago. But this is one thing that I like seeing that Rick Hahn and Ken Williams didn't do. Even, like, in the years where the White Sox were bad on purpose, there just wasn't very much roster churn. Like, I like this. I like, you just, like, a guy gets DFA that you like, claim him and play him, because it doesn't matter, right? And if you can unearth, like, a couple of guys that could be here for a while, I just, like, think that's a better use of resources than, like, running the same 40-man guys out over and over again that, you know, you're convinced, like, aren't going to be part of this thing in the future.
Well, that's been my point and kind of my rallying cry as I look for things to be positive about in this season is, in the past, we haven't seen this level of roster churn, and we haven't really seen the kind of savvy veteran pickups. I feel like Chris Getz, it's easy for fans to look at this and go, boy, this is a nightmare, this is horrible, and blame the people that they want to blame. But I feel like Chris Getz is getting these kind of small victories where you get a guy like Eric Fetty on a more friendly deal, you get a guy like Tommy Pham, and you have opportunities to turn those guys into prospects. That feels like what this season needs to be about.
Yeah, I think so, especially when you don't have any money to spend, right? So
yeah.
I think it's like the best course of action. Like, look, they're gonna get something for Chris Flexen. Like, that's insane to me, you know? Like, it's just kind of, and he's pitching really well, and that's the type of thing. And then, look, you're not going to get a ton, right? You're going to get the same thing that you likely just got from Texas, but it's like a free look at, like, a guy that might be able to pitch in your bullpen, like, in 2025. So, yeah, I do. I think you can say that some of the deals have been a negative, right? I think Dominic Fletcher hasn't been what they've anticipated, and they gave up a good pitching prospect for him. But, I mean, the Eric Fetty signing is a home run. They did well in the Dylan Cease trade. So, yeah, I think it's been pretty even so far, and I'm curious to see what they do at this deadline, because while it was, you know, it was the old front office, they did really, really well at last year's deadline,
yep.
And it kind of, again, I feel like it was a little bit ignored just because of, like, how bad of a spot the organization was in overall.
It feels like they're trending more that way to doing a good job again, and I think Getz has the right mindset in trying to flip some of the veterans. Chris Flexen's a great point. I don't think anybody expected him to be a legitimate trade candidate, but the way that he's pitched, if a team like, I'm just throwing them out there. I don't know that this will actually be the case, but I think about the Dodgers last year and how badly they needed pitching help. And we know organizationally they are always having kind of logjam prospects because they spend so much at the major league level. It's part of why Michael Busch wound up on the north side. If they're desperate for pitching help and you're holding Eric Fetty and Chris Flexen, they might have one of those logjam guys they can send this way.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense because even Chris Flexen, like, the one thing that is a benefit for him is he makes $1 million. So, you know, any of these teams that are, like, have luxury tax concerns, like, look, the Yankees aren't going to care, right? They're going to go get, like, yeah, the biggest guy available. But Fetty and Flexen both make a lot of sense for these luxury tax teams that are trying to win because Fetty makes $7.5 million and Flexen makes $1 million. You might get more than we even think for Flexen just because of, like, how cheap he is. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. I know White Sox fans are looking for anything to be excited about, and, you know, trading guys off the big league team to get worse, like, isn't necessarily one of those things, but it is the smart thing to do when you're going to win, like, 55 games, unfortunately.
James Fox of Future Sox, managing editor, podcast host, does great work. Love the work over at Future Sox. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right, more on the show. White Sox Weekly continues on. Some interesting takes this week from the White Sox players on the feeling inevitable automatic strike zone. I want to get into that a little bit next. It's White Sox Weekly, ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino, White Sox Network. It's White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Radio Network. Put your socks and sneakers to the test. Join us at Guaranteed Rate Field on Saturday, June 22nd for our annual White Sox 5K, presented by Illinois Corn Growers Association. Racers will cross the finish line on field, then can head up to the concourse for a post-race party. All net proceeds benefit White Sox charities. Register today at whitesox.com/run. I want to bring up something that I think is almost inevitable at this point to come to Major League Baseball, and that is the automatic strike zone. And I don't know if I'm alone in this. Would love to hear from you on it, 312-332-3776. But I feel like umpiring this season, it maybe hasn't been worse than on average. Maybe it really has been about the same, but we are seeing more examples of poor umpiring behind the plate, and I feel like it's under a larger microscope than maybe ever at any point in my time as a baseball fan. It feels like every day there is another clip of a home plate umpire ringing somebody up on a terrible pitch or walking somebody on a terrible pitch. I remember a couple weeks ago during the infamous 3-hour 10th inning rain delay game against St. Louis, Michael Kopech threw a pitch that was middle and was called a ball, I believe because it happened during a steal opportunity, and on the catcher's pop, the umpire was blocked from seeing exactly where the ball crossed the plate and just assumed ball, but it was a middle pitch that got called a ball. Baseball seems to be bringing the automatic strike zone in. It's been experimented at many levels in the minor leagues. It exists. The Hawkeye system, they call it, relays the call to the home plate umpire, who has all of the power taken from him and simply relays what the Hawkeye system says the pitch was, whether it was a ball or a strike. They call it, and it is what it is. The other system, and it's one that Gavin Sheets advocated for in the Sun-Times, is the challenge system, where, and I don't know what the logistics of this necessarily are, but managers or players would have the ability to challenge a ball and strike call. Obvious concerns there. It could potentially slow the game down if every wrong ball or strike were being challenged. I don't think they all would be. But it does bring up a kind of chicken or egg type of question of, if it's a bad call that creates a first strike, and we'll call it an 0-1 count, is that inherently better than a bad call that ends in a third strike and punches you out? You would assume yes, because the third strike call has a result attached to it. But the one strike call would fundamentally change the at-bat. I don't understand when you would necessarily want to challenge based on how bad a call is. And I don't know how many opportunities managers should be given to challenge. I understand this idea that seems to be what Gavin Sheets is talking about in his interview with the Sun-Times, retaining the human element of the game. There is this kind of traditionalist aspect to the sport of, we've had home plate umpires forever. The strike zone, I believe, has never been officially legislated. It doesn't really exist. It's a Fugazi type of thing. It's whatever the umpire decides the zone is. And this goes back forever. Some umpires have a wider zone than others. Some will call the high strike. Some won't. Some will only call the low strike. Some won't call the low strike at all. Some have an inch off the plate or an inch inside. That's kind of been how baseball's been played forever, and it allows consistency in the way that the game is played. The automatic strike zone would totally remove it. Everybody would have a consistent, same strike zone. It would be legislated, whatever they wanted to do. I know it used to be letters to knees. It seems like it's more top of the belt to knees now, if that's the way they wanted to go with it. Obviously, with adjustments on the height of the player in the batter's box, the imposing stature of those players tends to change it. A guy like Aaron Judge, for example, who is much taller than your average bear, will have a bigger strike zone than somebody like Tommy Pham. It's just, that's the way it works. So the adjustment there on the Hawkeye system would also exist. For me, I'm a little apprehensive about the automatic strike zone. Not because it removes the human element, but because I have concerns about its implement. I know that early in the process, there were players who were complaining that because if a pitch catches any part of the plate, it becomes a strike. There was some difficulty in, like, a pitch diving away, a breaking ball, just catching a corner, and it's completely unhittable, but it still gets called a strike because it caught the corner of the plate diving away. It really should be a ball, but the Hawkeye system registers. I'm apprehensive of how that gets implemented at the major league level. And I think what Gavin Sheets is saying is interesting. Now, there would have to be guardrails in place. You cannot have every at-bat being stopped for a ball strike reversal. However, I also think this is, like, arguably one of the quickest pathways of overturning a call. You watch the replay. Now, you'd have to legislate the strike zone so everybody has the same one. But you watch the replay, and if it's well off the plate and called a strike, or well above the strike zone and called a strike, then, yeah, we have a pretty quick reversal. We have a pretty quick overturn in that scenario. I think that that actually is better than the Hawkeye. I think it retains the part of this game that is umpires having their own consistent strike zone, the knowledge for a player that, hey, that pitch just off the plate outside is a strike today, and you have to understand that. And the challenge holds umpires accountable, which I believe is one of the biggest problems facing the sport right now. The total lack of accountability for umpires. And I'm not trying to be rude or disrespectful to anybody, but there are guys, and you know who they are, who are routinely on the wrong side of bad calls. There are certain umpires who seem to go more viral than others on social media, where this all seems to live. You got the umpire scorecard now. That's a great account on Twitter if you don't follow it and you're on Twitter. That will tell you the scorecard for an umpire in any given game, whether they were consistent in the way that they were calling balls and strikes, or whether they're inconsistent, whether they're accurate with what the strike zone looks like and is. That part is interesting to me as well. I think that what baseball really needs beyond an automatic strike zone is a certain level of accountability for the repeat offenders, the regular offenders. Brendan, am I correct in assuming that this is Jim in Kankakee here? All right, Jim, how are we doing? Good morning.
Hello. Question. I admit to being kind of a traditionalist. Do we need an automatic strike zone, or does MLB just need to do a better job of weeding out umpires who aren't getting the job done? I mean, there's a zillion services out there reading umpires and deciding, their percentage of good and bad strike calls.
Yeah, Jim, it's kind of what I was just hitting on is, for me, like, the automatic strike zone has its own set of problems. I think the fact that you're legislating exactly what the strike zone is and everybody gets the exact same one every at-bat, that can be a struggle for the baseball purist. It's not the way the game has ever been played. That's not to say we shouldn't allow baseball to evolve. We certainly should. And changes that could be better or improve the game in any level, whether it's pace of play or anything else, I don't think we should necessarily shy away from them for any reason. But the accountability thing to me is significantly more important. Now, baseball does have the Major League Baseball Umpires Association, which has become a sticking point. The fact that umpires are unionized in baseball can make it more difficult to levy an effective punishment or an effective repercussion for umpires who don't do a good job. Effectively, the repercussion that exists is, if you aren't a good crew, you don't get to umpire as many playoff games and you don't get to umpire LCSs or World Series. Does that really motivate those crews to do a better job? For some of the umpires out there who routinely do a very bad job at balls and strikes, is the fact that you're not going to be allowed to officiate a World Series game going to stop you from messing up calls in regular season games? And not to say regular season games are as meaningful as World Series games, but they do decide who gets into the playoffs and has an opportunity to play there. I don't know what the answer is, but I think on some level, baseball does need to accept that they either need, in the era of replay review, you either need to put the power in the hands of players and managers and allow them to have a system of holding umpires accountable on these calls, like Gavin Sheets talked about in the Sun Times. We want to have the ability to correct things when they're wrong. And this is a guy in Gavin Sheets who got tossed earlier this season from a game because he complained about two calls that were wrong. He was right both times, punched out on two calls that were well off the plate, well outside of the strike zone. And it's brutal for a player to go through that, where the bat is taken out of your hands, not by a pitcher, not by anything that happened in the game, but the bat is removed from your hands during an at-bat because of the umpire, and you're the person who's right in that situation, and the end result is you're ejected from the game. Right now, there is no pathway for the player or the manager to hold an umpire accountable. The automatic strike zone scares me in its implement. I think Gavin Sheets is onto something. If you'd like to weigh in, 312-332-3776. Should balls and strikes be challengeable in Major League Baseball rather than fully implementing an automatic strike zone? White Sox Weekly continues next. It's ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. White Sox Weekly, Connor McKnight has the day off. Shane Orland sitting in with you. 312-332-3776 if you'd like to weigh in on the show. I was just asking the question. Continue to take calls if you're interested. There's two kinds of schools of thought on the future of baseball as far as the strike zone is concerned. There's the automatic strike zone that's been experimented with, and there is also this Gavin Sheets idea. And this has also been experimented with, that players and managers should be afforded the right to challenge a ball or strike call if it's egregious. I kind of lean more the Gavin Sheets way. I think that's a more effective way of doing things. It retains a little bit of that human element and some of the inconsistency that happens with strike zones. Some umpires prefer to give that strike an inch off the plate. Some don't. Some have tighter strike zones. Some have wider. Some have higher. Some have lower. It goes every direction. And I think if you go with the challenge route, players know what to expect from an umpire on any given day as the game gets set in. And then in those later innings, if there's a call that's wildly out of place, they can challenge it. I think that is actually a better system than the fully automatic strike zone, which I think carries its own set of problems. This idea that has been gone around as it's been implemented and experimented with at the lower levels of professional baseball, where certain breaking pitches that just touch a part of the zone but really should not be strikes end up being called strikes, I don't think is an effective way to go forward if that continues to happen. I think they've refined it a little bit, but I do like the idea of having an opportunity to hold umpires accountable rather than totally take the game out of their hands. Sox fans, if you're looking for Memorial Day weekend plans, join us at the ballpark next Saturday, May 25th, as the Sox take on the Orioles at 1:10 p.m. The first 20,000 fans in attendance will receive a Luis Robert Jr. bobblehead presented by Wintrust. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Big story in Major League Baseball this year, and honestly, one of the most exciting young players I can remember in any sport in a while. There are very few prospects anymore since the Steven Strasburg debut, where I think baseball fans across the country stop and lock in. And we have one right now. And yesterday on the North Side, if you missed it, was incredible. You have a pitcher, 21 years of age, out of LSU, college arm, in Paul Skeens, in his second major league start ever. Threw 100-plus pitches, many of them over 100 miles an hour, struck out 11 and allowed no hits in six innings. Pirates beat the Cubs 9-3. It's Paul Skeens. Paul Skeens is insane. And watching him is one of those things where you kind of have to stop, and I don't want to say, like, oh, pinch me, I'm dreaming. But it's hard to believe what you're seeing is real. It's absolute gas when he's on the mound. His 10th strikeout yesterday, the pitch that was the strikeout pitch, checked in at 101.2 miles per hour. And that's deep into an outing where he threw over 100 pitches. There's some numbers from the Elias Sports Bureau that are, frankly, shocking. Keep in mind, this is a guy making his second career start. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, this was the first time a Pirate has struck out 11... excuse me, I want to make sure I get this number right. He got the Cubs to whiff on all six of their swings as they struck out in order in the first two innings, in the first inning, then struck out the side in the second, then opened up with a strikeout, seven up, seven down, seven strikeouts. That is the first time a Pirate has done that in the modern era since 1900. and there are more notable things. Seven up, seven down, all retired via the strikeout, with the first three all being on swings and misses, is incredible enough. Skeens was also the first Pirates pitcher to strike out 11 Cubs at Wrigley Field. Skeens also became the fourth Pirate pitcher to strike out at least 10 in a game before his 22nd birthday, joining Bob Moose, Nick Maddox, and John Candelaria, who was the most recent to do it. That was in 1975. Skeens' strikeout of Miles Mastroboni in the second inning was 101.2 miles an hour, matching his own record of for fastest strikeout by a Pirate pitcher in the pitch tracking era. He became just the third pitcher in the pitch tracking era to strike out the side on pitches registering at least 100 miles per hour. All three pitches that resulted in the strikeout were over 100. That joins Hunter Green and Bobby Miller. Hunter Green's done it twice in 2022. Bobby Miller did it last year in July of 2023. Had 22 swings and misses, 12 triple-digit mile-per-hour fastballs, and only allowed one hard hit ball. Now, what's really impressive about this is not only that it was his second career start. It was his second career start against the team that faced him in his first career start. Typically, if a team sees the same pitcher twice in a week, that guy might get shelled because you know what's coming. You've seen it before. And instead of Paul Skeens going out yesterday at Wrigley Field facing the Cubs for the second time in two starts, the first two starts of his career at 21 years old, he didn't get shelled. He had arguably the best pitching performance of the season so far. Really think about that, how impressive that is, and what we're seeing nationally. I know it's not local. I know it's Pittsburgh. I know very few people maybe care about this. But I think we are seeing a guy who has been billed as one of the elite all-time pitching prospects in that Mark Pryor vein, in that Steven Strasburg vein. That's what the billing has been. And he went out in his second career start and put together maybe the best pitching performance we will see all season. I think it's incredible what we are getting a chance to see with a young guy to have that level of billing. And on your 100th pitch, clock in at 100 miles per hour and strike out Mike Tauchman for the 11th strikeout of the game. It's cool to see him get his first win that way over the Cubs. It's cool to see him put an exclamation point on the day with a triple-digit fastball for the final strikeout, his 11th, six innings, no hits. If a guy like Paul Skeens could throw 150 pitches, he would have no-hit the Cubs yesterday. They weren't touching him. They weren't even getting close. They hit the ball hard, checks notes, one time. This guy is amazing. And if you have a chance to watch him, whether it's on MLB TV, the kind of league pass thing that they have, or when he's in the rarity that he's making a start locally, I think you have to take advantage of it. This is a guy you almost have to see live. If he's at the ballpark, I'll buy tickets to see him. I want to see him pitch live. I think he's that good. I think he's must-see television. I think he's must-listen radio. I think he's all of it. And this is exactly the kind of player that baseball needs. A pitcher like this who's that electric. I want to also add in an interesting note that I saw last night, and it's one of those, I don't want to call it the stat of the day, but it's just a nationally kind of bizarre thing that happened yesterday. The Arizona Diamondbacks played the Detroit Tigers and got blown out. And the Tigers had their ace, Tarek Skubal, on the mound. And he is becoming a rather prohibitive favorite to win the American League Cy Young. Eric Fetty, of course, in that conversation as well. Tarek Skubal had one of the weirdest stats I think I've ever seen. Entering his final inning in the sixth inning, the Tigers had the lead 13-0. And Tarek Skubal, in a game that had lasted over an hour and 40 minutes, had been on the mound for 16 minutes and 45 seconds. I don't think I've ever seen a stat like that. But it just goes to show, and I'm fitting this in for the Paul Skeens conversation for a reason. I think we're at a very kind of special point in baseball fandom, where a few years ago we started seeing some of the legacy players, the Bo Bichettes, the Vlad Guerrero Juniors, the Fernando Tatis Juniors, these guys getting fast-tracked through the minor leagues and starting to play at younger ages. Tatis, I think, was 20 years old when he debuted, and he was incredible. I think we're at a point in baseball where it used to be the Verlanders, the Scherzers, all these guys who are now of the veteran age, approaching 40, over 40 in some cases. We're at the passing of the torch moment, where now you've got Paul Skeens on the hill doing things that have almost never been done before in his second career start. You've got a guy like Tarek Skubal in his mid-20s, 26 years old, I think, contending for a Cy Young Award. It's around the league that the young players are really starting to come up and shine. You think about Corbin Carroll last year for the Diamondbacks and how electric he was for a team that wasn't expected to be especially great, but wound up making a World Series run behind a kid in Corbin Carroll who was a Rookie of the Year winner and MVP candidate. I think it's fascinating the point baseball's at nationally, where maybe it never will be on the big stage again with the NFL's dominance. Maybe it never will have that level of national recognition and popularity, but it feels like it's in an especially good place, certainly in its regional aspects, when so many of the most talented players across this league are in their 20s. It feels like a very exciting time to be a baseball fan. And it feels like a lot of these prospects in this sport specifically that get billed as generational can't miss, they've been successful more than they have not. I think it's a cool time to be a fan. I enjoy watching some of this out-of-market national stuff. And I think it's an opportunity to see things we haven't seen from players who are of an age that we haven't seen it from. It used to be the school of thought that pitchers could peak in their 30s, and it just feels like now we're getting it when they're 21. That's incredible to me. It's White Sox Weekly. We'll continue next on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. It's White Sox Weekly. Connor McKnight with the day off, but you'll hear from him in a moment. On ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Shane Orling sitting in for Connor today. But Connor did catch up with Mike Petriello earlier this week. Had a great conversation. We want to play that for you here.
Joining us now on White Sox Weekly is Mike Petriello of MLB.com. You may know him from things like his Twitter profile that says, doing the baseball things at MLB.com. You may also know him from us reading just about every article of his on White Sox Weekly every week. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Dying to get into the bat tracking stuff that you guys have come out with on BaseballSavant.com.
Yeah, it's super exciting. This is a big deal for us. The way I've been telling people about it is every year, including the playoffs, there's about 350,000 swings. And up until last week, we could tell you just about nothing about them other than how they relate to the ball, right? We could say, did you chase a bad pitch? Did you hit the ball hard? Did you hit the ball on the ground? Whatever. But if you think about everything we have known about pitches and pitchers over the last 15 years and how pitchers continually get ahead of the curve and the batters are the ones always trying to adjust, this is kind of a big deal, I think. And I'm really interested to see what the baseball public does with this new information.
So that was obviously the push for why track bat speed. But now that we've got this data out here, at first blush, I mean, it's only been a couple of days on Baseball Savant. What is it to you that makes bat tracking so important from the hitting side then? You know, not just looking at the black hole of less information as opposed to the pitching side of things.
You know, it's interesting because I will have a different answer to that question 1 year from now and 2 years from now, because as you said, we've only got data since the beginning of this season, right? So we got 5 or 6 weeks worth of data. What I want to be able to say is, oh, after 5 years, you know, your bat speed declines or your squared up rate goes down or whatever. We just don't know the answer to that yet because it's all so new. But I think what's cool is when we put out some of the stuff, like the names sort of match the eye test to some extent. Like if you look at the top 10 or 15 hardest swings, well, yeah, you're going to find Ronald Acuña Jr. and Julio Rodriguez and Yordan Alvarez. And at the bottom, you're going to find Luis Arraez and you're going to find Stephen Kwan. And I think that's all to be expected. But I think the key takeaway here, at least as far as bat speed goes, is that on the whole, you want it. It's like fastball velocity, right? If you take a whole bunch of guys who throw hard, they will be better pitchers most likely than the ones who don't. But it doesn't mean that Luis Arraez can't be a great hitter, right? It doesn't mean that Kyle Hendricks can't be a very good pitcher at his peak, even though he's throwing 89. It's a skill. It's a tool. But none of this is the end-all, be-all answer to every question.
So Len Casper passed along kind of the info sheets that you guys had going around to me, and he and I kind of nerded out about it for a while, and he was like, you got to call Mike. And I was like, yo, obviously I got to call Mike. We got to have him on the show. And he wanted to know that the eye test that you're talking about here, right? Like, a lot of these metrics have validated what coaches have been coaching and scouts have been scouting and front offices have been front officing here. Is there anything that does stand out so far as counterintuitive about these bat tracking metrics?
That's an interesting question. I don't know about counterintuitive, but I like the ones where it's not so clear as this end is good and this end is bad, right? Like if you square up a ball, that's obviously great. You want to do that. We put out one metric that was about swing length because hitters have been talking about this forever. You know, who's got a long swing, who's got a short, quick swing. And going back to the eye test, Javier Baez has the longest swing and Arraez has the shortest swing. And I can tell you when I first saw that in the testing room, I was like, great, we nailed it.
That's we did perfect. It. We got it.
Exactly what it should be. Book it and move on. But that one is cool to me because it's not so much, you know, a short swing is good and a long swing is bad. It's really about styles. It's about types of hitters. You know, a short swing, you're probably going to make a little more contact. You're probably going to do it with a little less power. A long swing, you're probably going to strike out more, but when you hit it, you might have a little bit more power. And I do like that one because a lot of this just comes down to, you know, storytelling and putting numbers to the kind of things that scouts have been writing down in their notebooks for 100 years. And that one stands out to me because I think a lot of the other stuff people were expecting, and this was maybe a little bit more of a surprise that people didn't see coming.
So, Mike, do you expect to talk with Mike Petriello of MLB.com here on White Sox Weekly about all the new bat tracking stuff on Baseball Savant? So then, do we expect splits in a way for different hitters? Like, would you expect to see over the course of time 0-2 swings by Luis Robert Jr. to be slower so as to make more contact? Or maybe something like a lefty swinging a little bit slower against a lefty pitcher so as to make more contact because he's facing the platoon disadvantage there?
Yeah, those are great questions. And the fun answer is we don't even have to wait for that. You can do that right now. So one of the fun things about this is I always like to take any kind of advanced metric we have or new technology or whatever and find some old baseball chestnut and compare it to, because more often than not, it actually confirms it. It doesn't destroy it. And people like to say, well, you know, guys have been shortening up on two swings forever, but now in today's game, they strike out. They don't care about two strikes. And it turns out, if you sort the whole league by, you know, zero strike or one strike and you compare it to two strikes, they drop their bat speed by about a mile and a half. They
wow.
drop their fast swing rate by 10 percentage points. Not true across the board. Like Giancarlo Stanton, for example, swings all out all the time, no matter what. But there are examples like Fernando Tatis Jr. is a good one. He drops his two strike miles per hour on a swing by like 3 miles an hour. Like he's really trying to do this. And I think that's interesting. I think that's really cool because that's something that's analytically interesting, but I think also very satisfying to even just like an old school baseball fan that you can actually see which guys are and are not doing that.
Do bat tracking stats have to normalize? We hear a lot about defensive numbers, for instance, needing some time to mean something or catcher framing or stuff like this. It seems like this would be a number that stays fairly constant if health is also a given here.
Yeah, great question. This is one of the fastest to mean something stats that we have. Again, going back to fastball velocity, you don't need to see someone like, I don't know, Michael Kovac throw a lot of fastballs to know he can throw fast, right? It's the same thing here. You know, like I said, Stanton at the top and Arraez at the bottom. That's not going to change. That's not going to normalize that over time. And we have had some smart people, both internally and externally, run some fancy data regressions on all this. And depending on how you do it, it's between 2 and 5 swings from a guy. And you could say, yeah, I get it. That's going to be meaningful. I don't think that's going to change. And 2 and 5 swings is like a game, too. Like, you will know that so fast, and I like that a lot about this.
Wow. So how does that correlate? Because, you know, White Sox fans at this point, you know, we're looking for the Colson Montgomerys and Brian Ramoses and Edgar Caros. How is this bat tracking data working, or how would you like to see it work, maybe is a better question since it is so new, as it regards prospects rising through the ranks or players making their MLB debuts? How are we kind of evaluating what's to come from some of baseball's youngest?
Yeah, that's a really important point to make, I think. This is brand new to the public in the sense that nobody who doesn't work for a team or whatever could have found this information publicly before yesterday. All 30 teams, or I should say most of the teams, I guess I don't know for sure about some of the, you know, bottom-end teams, have had versions of this before, whether in their ballparks, in their hitting labs, in their minor league affiliates. There is no team who saw this come out this week and go, oh, wow, we never had this information before. So every team has had a version of this where they've been working on their guys, you know, or send them to a driveline or something like that. So I'm not sure this is necessarily going to change the way that the players react or the teams make any moves, unless there are some players who, you know, aren't familiar with their own metrics and go look it up, because we know that happens too. But I would say this is much, much more of a public facing and like storytelling tool, and maybe less so of a player evaluation tool, just because the players have already had access to this.
I know a lot of care went into all of this, and it's so much more than just one number, right? You've talked about swing length and bat speed and all this kind of stuff. But in baseball, as fans, right, who have a math degree or don't have a – or can barely do math like myself, I can't make change on a sandwich purchase. But we like to get baseball down to one number, like wins above replacement or something like that. Which one would you highlight of all of this suite of numbers to somebody who's really interested in this but kind of needs an entry point?
I would say something that is both simple and effective. And for that, I would look at fast swing rate. So the average swing is 72 miles an hour. We have defined 75 miles an hour as the threshold for being a fast swing. Happy accident. This is not actually how it was planned. That's also the average swing for a home run. And that works out pretty nicely for us, even though that's not the way it was planned. So to give anybody the answer to the question of, you know, what do I do with this? Why does any of this matter? You look at a fast swing, right? Over 75 miles an hour and over, the aggregate, 306 batting average and a 600 slugging. Underneath, 247 average and a 370 slugging. Like, those are massive differences. And again, it doesn't mean Luis Arraez can't be successful. Like, he totally can be. Doesn't mean Giancarlo Stanton's the best hitter in baseball. He is not. But on the whole, those are huge, huge differences. And the players themselves are telling you this, right? You've got Mookie Betts. You've got Lars Nootbaar. You've got all these guys saying, I am trying to increase my bat speed. The pitchers are throwing it faster. I need to swing faster to make up for it. And the numbers bear that out.
So, Mike, like you've said, as we let you go here, it sounds like a lot of teams have had this information for a little while, or kinds of this information for a while, and been messing around with this and evaluating their players. As I understand it, organizations that kind of throw this stuff out in the front-facing public often hear from teams about what they got right and how they've been looking at it and kind of giving you a little, you know, just the old head nod kind of as they pass down the street. I have to imagine that you've gotten a head nod or two from some organizations. I'm not asking you to name them, but we seem to be on this, right? I mean, this seems to be where teams were for years now.
Yeah, I can confirm that is true, and I can also confirm that is not always true. There have definitely been times we've put something out, and we've had people who work for teams or for the hitting lab say, hey, I'm not so sure about this, you might want to review it. But for this, it's been pretty well received. I can tell you, if you didn't see, I went on the ESPN Sunday night broadcast of Mets Braves the other night to talk about this, and I got a message from someone who works for a big market team, and he said, and I quote, our whole biomechanical group saw the broadcast, and we were so excited. And I don't say that to pump up my own ability to talk on TV, but just that the nerds like have wanted this out for a long time. And now that it's out, you can talk about it a little better. People are more familiar with it. Maybe some third-party people will take the data and come up with some really interesting projects I could have never have conceived, which I'm really excited about. So I do think that for the most part, the industry is pretty interested. I think you're going to see a lot more of this.
Man, congratulations to you and the crew over there. That's really exciting stuff, and I'm thrilled to see what you guys are all doing with this. This is great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
That was Connor McKnight with Mike Petriello of MLB.com. Some awesome new bat tracking data becoming available. Right now, let's pause 10 seconds for station identification. It's White Sox Weekly. Connor McKnight with the day off. Shane Orling's sitting in for Connor today on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. And enjoy an all-inclusive game day experience on the CIBC Fan Deck. Perfect for hosting your group of friends, family, clients, or colleagues. It includes customizable food and beverage package. For more information, visit whitesox.com/party areas or call 312-674-1000. That's 312-674-1000. White Sox lost last night in the series opener against the Yankees, but it hasn't really been bad lately. After a nightmare April, the White Sox are 8-7 in the month of May, and they've won 8 of their last 13 games. You don't have to squint as hard to find some of the positivity anymore. It actually is starting to stand out a little bit. I was doing a little research on FanGraphs this morning just to see some of the more team-wide, league-wide statistics. And if you isolate the month of May, now this is a small sample size, but if you isolate the month of May and the 15 games that the White Sox have played so far, I already told you they're 8-7, so the results are more positive than they were in April. But the team ERA ranks 8th in baseball. The team also ranks 8th in baseball in pitching wins above replacement at FanGraphs in the month of May. Top 3rd for the pitching staff. Bullpen, starters, all of it. That is a really good sign. And I'm not here to tell you that it's a pitching staff that's going to remain intact when you look at where some of the best performances are coming from. I don't need to tell you about Eric Fetty. You already know. He's 4-0, 2.6 ERA. He's been outstanding this season. 154 ERA plus. The strikeout factor is there. 50 strikeouts in 52 innings to just 14 walks allowed. Fetty's been fantastic. So fantastic, Chuck Garfein was asking Ozzie Guillen if it's too early to start talking about a potential Cy Young as Eric Fetty leads American League pitchers in wins above replacement. And I'm not here to tell you he's going to win a Cy Young. I think Corbin Burnes and Tarek Skubal have a pretty firm grasp on that as we approach June. One of those two seem to be the eventual AL Cy Young winner, but Fetty has pitched close to that caliber. It's not incredibly likely that Fetty will be here beyond the trade deadline, but that doesn't have to be a bad thing. When you have a vet on a friendly deal pitching this well, and you see things like what the White Sox did earlier this week in sending a prospect from the Complex League, an international player, to the Astros for Corey Jolks, who was a positional logjam victim, just couldn't get playing time in the Astros outfield, and now he's here. That is, as James Fox told me earlier in the show, a free look at a player who you don't know what he's going to be, but it's a guy who hit 31 home runs a couple of years ago in AAA, and you are getting virtually a totally free look at him. I think with Eric Fetty, the same thing can be true. And you think about teams like the Dodgers, like the Braves, who put more resources into the major league club, but have really high-level minor league foundations. They don't have the space for those minor league bats, for those minor league arms, because they're so resource heavy at the pro level, MLB level, that you can kind of use those farm systems by giving them something they might need. In the case of the Dodgers, think about last year. Their pitching rotation was devastated. It was the one weakness on that club. Could you get them to ship you a logjam minor league player for somebody like Fetty? I think that that's a possibility. So when you see this team playing well, I'm not here to tell you that the answers are all solved and we're going to see them play above 500 baseball. It's a small sample size that they have played above 500 baseball, but I think if Chris Getz is savvy enough, he can use this to his advantage and build his team for the future via some of the things that are going well. Chris Flexen, Bob Nightingale reported earlier this week, is becoming a hot name on the trade market. The ERA is not standout at 4.46, but we've seen guys in the past get moved with 4.5 ERAs for good prospects for teams that are desperate enough for pitching. Pitching is hard to find. And the White Sox have ample opportunity to give contending teams good pitching and receive good players back, good prospects back, build up a farm system that currently ranks in the bottom third in Major League Baseball and create something better through some of the moves Chris Getz has made. You look at this bullpen, you almost can't say enough, and it feels like it's a running storyline the past couple of seasons where the results on the field aren't what we were hoping for, but the bullpen is outstanding, and this year I think, again, you might have an opportunity to take some advantage of that. Michael Kopech, 121 ERA plus. It's still a little inconsistent. There are days where he's effectively wild, and there are days where he's just wild. But overall, the big picture of the results, it's looking good. Jordan Leisure, 25 years old, a 196 ERA this year in 19 appearances, 18 innings. Only 4 earned runs, 13 strikeouts. You're seeing a guy there with a 206 ERA plus. That means he's 106% better than Major League average. That's in your bullpen. Steven Wilson's been excellent in the bullpen. Tim Hill's been excellent in the bullpen. I think we're starting to see this pitching staff come into a place where it is, I don't want to say top of the league, but a little bit legitimate. And there are pieces that you can build on going forward. Now, I don't think Michael Soroka, Mike Clevinger are those pieces, but Crochet getting experience this season, having finally more appearances, 10 so far this year, his ERA starting to stabilize after a stretch where he struggled a little bit, and the strikeout stuff certainly is there, 70 strikeouts in 51 and two-thirds innings. And the walks are down for Crochet, only 12 walks on the year. He's still only 25 years old. He's still got a bright future in front of him, and that's an asset you can hold on to while using some of the guys like Fetty and Flexen to create a better future. The offense is what the offense is. The Tommy Pham acquisition is smart, and you can turn it into, hopefully, good minor league players, good prospect-level players. But it's a good acquisition for a guy who's now hitting .338 on the season with an .866 OPS. 3 hits last night in New York in the loss. That's a positive sign, and it gives Chris Getz, the general manager, some flexibility, some wiggle room to make moves to alter the future of this team. I think it's all there for him, and I think we just have to hope he can get these little victories from some of these signings that he's made and get this team better. White Sox set to take on the Yankees today. The first pitch coming up in a little over an hour. Len and DJ on the call. And Sox fans, don't forget to enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win the Ultimate Game Day experience. May's winner will get 4 Diamondbacks tickets to 1 home game, plus the chance to throw out the first pitch, tour the broadcast booth, watch batting practice, and receive a custom White Sox jersey. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. A little more on some of the positivities, the signs, the good signs that I've been seeing with the White Sox as of late. And I want to talk about the New York Yankees and a very interesting documentary I started watching this weekend. We'll do that next. White Sox Weekly continues on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. White Sox Weekly, as we get you set for the White Sox pregame show coming your way. About 15 minutes. White Sox and Yankees set to play in New York. First pitch shortly after noon. We'll get you to the call of the game with Len and DJ. Pregame show soon. On the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. And Sox fans, head to the ballpark on Sunday, June 9th, as we celebrate your favorite Fuzzy Green Dude's birthday. Join Southpaw and his friends for a special pregame patio party celebration when you purchase a specially priced ticket. There is limited availability, so act fast. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Our last segment, I was talking a little bit about some of the more positive signs we've seen from the White Sox in the month of May. There's no hiding from the fact that April was kind of a nightmare. Everything was bad. That has not been the case so far in the month of May. You have an 8-7 record in the month. 8 of the last 13 games have been wins. So after a slow start in the month of May, they started to put things together. 8-5 in the last 13. And the pitching has been outstanding. Top third of the league, 8th at Fangraphs in wins above replacement in the month of May on the pitching staff. But that's not the only place to look for signs of improvement. The offense is what it is. And we know that the probably best player in the lineup right now, Tommy Pham, is likely not going to be in Chicago past the trade deadline. That's not a certainty, but it feels like the process Chris Getz would want to take as the general manager. But there is a bat that started to get a little hot. Andrew Vaughn had a nightmare start to the season. Wasn't hitting for average, certainly wasn't hitting for power. Had to wait until May 10th for his first home run of the season. But he started to hit better lately, with the average climbing as it got as low as 183 on May 7th, now up to 213. And I'm not saying that the numbers look pretty for the full season. The OPS still isn't where you want it. The OPS Plus still isn't where you want it. But in the past week, Vaughn's had 3 multi-hit games, including a 2-home run game against Washington just the other day. In the second game of that series, the White Sox won 4-0. So for a guy that had 0 home runs for the first month and a half, roughly, of the season, you're now looking at 3 home runs in a little over a week, and it feels like one of the most important bats in the White Sox lineup is starting to find his swing. Former third overall pick, the pedigree is there. The expectation for Vaughn was to be a high-level bat at first base. That's why you take a first baseman that high in the draft. It's not for defense. Major League Baseball doesn't view first base as a premium defensive position. It's where you put a guy who can field a little bit and hit for power. And the hope is that Andrew Vaughn can become that. And things were starting to look dire as the first month and a half goes, and batting just 183 with a 230 slugging. OPS as low as 471 then. Now OPS approaching 600 as he started to heat up. The extra base hits are starting to get there. 3 doubles in this month. 4 doubles in the month. 3 home runs. Obviously, improvement. I'm not telling you it's been stellar, but it's heading more in the right direction. And look, some of the teams in baseball historically that are on the younger side, that are filled more with team-friendly veteran talent than they are with big contracts, that are filled more with younger players who admittedly have struggled, they can get off to really cold starts in April. And the Sox caught bad injury luck. Aloy Jimenez missed time. Luis Robert still working back from time with the hope that a rehab assignment can start as soon as next week. Pedro Grifol had that information for us earlier this week. And that's good news. Luis Robert coming back sooner than expected would be fantastic for a Sox lineup that badly needs his bat. Yoan Moncada went down, 60-day injured list. So while the Sox, I don't think, are going to be a contending team or start to play above 500 baseball for the remainder of the year, I still think this team will be a seller at the deadline and try to repair a little bit of the minor league system. There is help on the way, and the hope that some of these younger bats that have struggled so mightily to start this season can find a little bit of a groove and get back to it. We're starting to see signs that that could happen. Another bright spot in this lineup, and it's not an everyday player, but it's one who, when he's playing well, when he's in the lineup, plays very well. Corey Lee, you almost can't say enough about in his 86 appearances, hitting over 300, an OPS plus of 133, means 33% better than your average player. To have a guy like that at the catcher position who is just 25 in his age 25 season and has an opportunity to develop into an everyday catcher who could be a high-level bat in this lineup, 4 home runs on the year, I like to look at a season that can, for fans, easily feel so negative and find a couple bright spots. And I think Corey Lee is one of them. I'm not going to tell you the only bright spot this year is that some of the one-year guys are going to get moved for decent prospects. Because it's difficult to root for as a fan. it's difficult for the only thing that you can root for to be that guys we will get rid of will turn into decent players in the future. I think there are a couple guys you can look at right now, certainly in the pitching staff. Crochet as he starts to put it together, but Corey Lee at the catcher position could end up being a really good acquisition for the White Sox. Doesn't strike out much, only 17 on the season. And hitting over 300 with a little bit of power, four home runs, some extra base hit ability. That's a good thing to see as well. 312-332-3776 is the phone number for you. And don't forget, head to the ballpark on Sunday, June 9th. As, again, we celebrate your favorite Fuzzy Green Dude's birthday. Join Southpaw and his friends for a special pregame patio party celebration when you purchase a specially priced ticket. Limited availability to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/promos. I did want to bring up something I watched, and it's relevant with the White Sox playing the Yankees today. On Peacock, there is a new documentary available, and it's based on a series of New York Post articles back in the day about the 1990s Yankees. And if you're unfamiliar with the 1990s New York Yankees, this is a stellar watch. It's hard to believe for me. I was born in 94. I was born basically at the start of the Yankees dynasty with Jeter, Pettit, Rivera, Posada, all of those iconic players. I was born when they started getting good. And it's hard for me to fathom at my age for a team that's won, I believe, 27 World Series championships, won it in 2009, won the titles in the late 90s and early 2000s, and obviously their historic success. It's difficult for me to fathom that there was a period that could be as dark for a franchise like that as there was for the Yankees. But watching this documentary on Peacock and seeing some of the stories about George Steinbrenner and about the Yankees that I was unfamiliar with. The Mel Hall story, dating a girl in high school, and everybody around the team and everybody around the media was just kind of like aware of it and all good. Yeah, Mel Hall's girlfriend's in high school. She was present at the Yankee games while the Yankees were the worst team in the American League East. And it's unbelievable that something that insane was happening and people were just enabling and allowing it. It's equally unbelievable that the 1990 Yankees team was so bad that there was a game at Comiskey Park against the White Sox where the Yankees threw a no-hitter in nine innings. Andy Hawkins, the pitcher, threw a nine-inning no-hitter against the White Sox, and the White Sox beat the Yankees 4-0 in a no-hitter. Because of three consecutive errors in the outfield and just an inability by a Yankee offense to have a chance of hitting a baseball for extra bases. The Steinbrenner craziness of needing a flash in the pan, needing something that the fans could grab onto. So he signed Deion Sanders for non-baseball reasons, but basically because let's hope he can be Bo Jackson. It's a total circus, the 1990 Yankees. And there is so much more. I grew up hearing the name Dave Winfield. And I knew Dave Winfield was an elite player. And I knew he was this kind of storied Yankee. I didn't realize that him and George Steinbrenner spent a decade publicly warring in the newspaper. If this happened in 2024, it would be a major league owner going to war on social media with a player on his own team. Steinbrenner using the headlines to vilify a fan favorite in Dave Winfield. Steinbrenner dragging out Yankee legend Don Mattingly's contract talks because he was so stubborn. It's fascinating. It's incredible because it feels prescient in the way that you see some franchises in baseball run today where things can get so ugly and you're like, how could this happen? To think that it could happen to the Yankees. Steinbrenner, a relationship with a professional gambler who he got connected with in trying to dig dirt on Dave Winfield in an effort to move Dave Winfield out of New York. The stories that I learned, cougars in the clubhouse, and the quote is, not 53-year-old ladies, actual cougars, the animal, in the clubhouse. It's like the Phoenix Suns under Robert Sarver, but the New York Yankees with George Steinbrenner, and I had no idea about it. I started watching it this weekend, and it's blowing my mind how dysfunctional that franchise was. White Sox Yankees coming up next, the pregame show on ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.